You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Wednesday, October 15th. And here with me in the studio to ride through this hour today is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Adora.
Just this morning, Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson said that he expects improvement in the condition of the economy over time, but that there will be, quote, a bump in the road along the way. This a day after Secretary Paulson called each of the nine largest banks' chiefs into a meeting and essentially demanded that they sign on the dotted line on a program to inject cash into the banking system. But it was a meeting that sounds like it was full of drama. Mark Landler, who wrote an article for the New York Times, he's covering the story for the New York Times with Eric Dash, joins us now from Washington. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Adora.
You don't necessarily associate bankers and drama in the same sentence, but it sounds as if this meeting yesterday came as quite a surprise to some of the bankers when Secretary Paulson described his plan. What happened?
Well, essentially, on Sunday, sometime in the late afternoon, Mr. Paulson began calling the CEOs of the nine largest banks individually in person and told them to report to his conference room Monday at 3 p.m., didn't tell them what the subject was. And they spent, I'm sure, a nervous evening trying to figure it out. And by all accounts, none of them figured that they would be asked basically to accept a government investment in their bank and given no choice, and not only that, given less than 3.5 hours to make the decision. So to call it a surprise is probably an understatement.
So they're sitting in this meeting, and the secretary lays out very specific details. Was there screaming and yelling? Was there discomfort? I mean, if they were that shocked, what was the reaction?
Well, from what we understand from talking to a number of people who were in the room, there was a good deal of discomfort. I think I would stop short of saying there was screaming and shouting, but there was a very, very tense exchange between several of the bankers and Mr. Paulson, and some of it focused on and came from the bankers from banks that were quite healthy, that didn't feel they needed government money, that worried having the government as a shareholder, what would that mean for other shareholders, and even made a kind of a cultural point. The chairman of Wells Fargo said, look, I'm based in San Francisco. I've stayed far away from these fancy mortgage-backed securities that you guys on Wall Street got into, and now I'm sitting in a room having to talk about bailing you out. So there was a good deal of hard feeling, but also by all accounts, they came on board pretty fast because the inevitability of it and the lack of any better options was so clear to them.
Outline the plan, the $125 billion plan.
Well, essentially, the government will buy what's called perpetual preferred shares in each of these banks. The size of the investment is roughly equivalent to the size of the assets on the balance sheet. The government will hold those shares for some period of time, presumably a few years. With each investment comes the right for the government to buy warrants equivalent to 15% of the investment. So if they were to invest $100 million into a bank, they'd have the right to buy $15 million worth of warrants, which after a period of years can convert into common stock. Now, that's really important because the issue that shareholders have with government injections of capital is that it dilutes other shareholders. And that's not something that's good for the banks, for the shareholders. Nobody likes it. And the government has structured this in a way to give the banks an incentive to raise capital from other places before that conversion would ever happen. And so essentially they would buy the government out, and the government would only be a non-voting preferred shareholder for the entire time that they were invested in each bank.
So Mark, now that this deal is done, do these nine banks essentially have to start lending now and borrowing? Or if they don't have to under the rules, is there such political and public pressure on them now that they essentially have to start lending, now that they have this money?
I think that that's very much the message. I mean, Mr. Paulson said it in the news conference yesterday. He said it in the meeting directly to them. He said, you know, I don't want you to hoard this cash. I want you to deploy it. So the point here, and I think the political pressure will be overwhelming, is that this is how you unlock the credit markets. This is how you get these banks lending to each other. And that's why he was very careful to, number one, give cash to all 9 banks and not to distinguish between banks that were a little bit shaky, which several of them are, and then the ones that are healthy. Because his point is, this isn't designed to resuscitate failing banks. It's designed to take healthy banks and persuade them to start lending.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, the rationale of taking a Wells Fargo, which was healthy, but also lots of 7 or 8 banks that aren't as healthy. Lumping them all in together sends the message, you are all in this together. There are no outliers here. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And then to look at it from the negative point of view, the big fear they had is, let's say they'd made the program very voluntary, very open-ended, which would be closer to what happened in Britain. They also took in 8 of their largest banks into a room and made them essentially the same offer, but it was much more voluntary. In Britain, Barclays, one of the biggest banks, and not actually a bank that's extremely strong, opted not to take the money. And so there is a stigma attached to taking government money, and the fear was if they didn't really make it all but mandatory, a couple of the banks would peel off. There'd be a lot of infighting between them. You know, you took government money, you're a bailout, I'm not. By doing it this way, you remove the stigma. It's part of almost a national effort, if you will.
Mark, let's talk about some of the strings attached. I mean, you really describe an extraordinary scene, which is the secretary and these 9 heads of the banks sitting there drinking coffee and drinking Coke and talking about these things. What is the government demanding in return for the money that's being injected into these banks?
Well, there is a school of thought that they're not actually demanding that much. There is a dividend that you have to pay on the preferred stock. It also goes up after 5 years from 5% to 9%. Again, another mechanism to persuade the banks to buy out the government before you get to 5 years. But there's no very stringent control provisions. For example, there's nothing in the agreement that says that the bank needs to call Hank Paulson before they make any kind of an investment. There is, and this is important, there is a fairly strict restriction on executive compensation. An executive who leaves a bank that has government money in it can't get a golden parachute. Any compensation over $500,000 is not tax deductible.
But let me stop you there for a second, because there's essentially a caveat there, isn't there? I mean, you know, the chief of Wells Fargo Bank, apparently, according to some reports, and you talk about this in your story,
mm-hmm.
has potentially tens of millions of dollars that he'll receive when he leaves the bank. This agreement wouldn't touch the package that he's already has in, say, a contract, I would assume.
That's right. And that's why there's a little bit of sort of discussion going on about getting underneath those compensation restrictions and really trying to figure out how strict they are. And some people are arguing they're not actually that strict. If this guy can leave and get hundreds of millions in payout and it's not actually covered by any of these restrictions, well, how tough are they? Mr. Paulson's argument is they're really tough, and in fact he made them even tougher than what Congress passed in the bailout bill. But there are people saying, look, there's ways to get around stuff. And you know, frankly, with the exception of the chairman of Wells Fargo, there wasn't a huge debate about the executive compensation issue during this meeting. It was more focused on other things.
Well, Mark, you mentioned Congress, and I wonder how much certainty these bank CEOs, these 9 bank CEOs who had their hands held as they signed on the dotted line, how much certainty do they have about what this deal is going to look like after Congress gets its bite at this apple? You know, Barney Frank is out there, Chris Dodd, they're both out there saying they are coming back to regulate and they want more oversight. You said there's not a lot of oversight on the kinds of transactions the banks might make with this money. So do they have certainty going forward that the game's not going to change?
Well, under the bailout bill that Paulson got through Congress and that Congress passed, it gave him authority in this area. It was in the bill. He's not asking for anything additional. And because the bill was very focused on asset repurchases, it doesn't actually talk in extreme detail about capital injections. Of course, Congress will talk about strengthening oversight, and that is in the original bill. So I think you'd have to say, with the government as a shareholder for the first time in your history, of course you have uncertainty. That said, Mr. Paulson thinks he has fairly broad authority in this area and will probably fight very strongly to retain that authority in how he designs the program going forward.
Mark Landler, it's always a great pleasure. Thank you so much for that report.
Thanks, Adora.
Mark Landler, coming to us from the New York Times in Washington, D.C., covering what's happening at the Treasury Department and the federal bailout plan to inject cash into the banking system. And Todd Zwillix, also here with us from the Capital News Connection.
Uncertain times.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.